Last week we were in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, part 2, I guess, of that little three-letter word that can create such interesting and sometimes difficult situations. We talked about marriage and celibacy and divorce last time. If we were to continue to read in chapter 7, we would also find that Paul keeps that same thought, that same idea going into further areas as well. Thank you. As he talks even more about the fact that the unmarried, well, the Christian, whatever his or her marital status, should seek to rise above their circumstances and live for Christ. That's in chapter 7, verses 17 and following. Regardless of where you find yourself in life, regardless of what you find going on, that you should seek, since you belong to the Lord, if you are a Christian, you should seek to rise above the circumstances. Now, you can't do that by yourself, but you can do that along with Christ's assistance and the assistance of others around you. He continues throughout the rest of chapter 7 to talk about how that if you, and he does come down talking about wives at the end, saying she's bound to her husband as long as her husband lives. If he dies, she can marry another Christian, but in his opinion, it's better not to marry because you can give more service to God. But I think it would go both ways. And he continues that. It's really an emphasis toward the end on what we are free to do as opposed to what we might elect to do. You're free to do a number of things, whether you elect to do them is in part dependent upon how that fits not only in your life, but fits as you relate to other persons around you, Christian and non-Christian, which is kind of an end to that discussion, but the very beginnings of his next discussion in chapter 8. And as he begins, similarly to chapter 7, chapter 7 he said, "Now about the things that you wrote to me concerning," now he says, "now concerning food sacrificed to idols," obviously that is a question, and that has been written back to Paul as well. And in chapters 8 and following, he really deals with one's sense of what is right as and one's rights as opposed to one's privileges, and how we view that and how we go about reaching out to others or not. Do we take our rights simply because we have them and by golly I can do it so I'm going to do it? Or do we defer and relinquish what our rights are because it is better for someone else or for the whole that we not demand those rights? I know, once again, this is one of those sections of Paul's letters that has nothing to do with the postmodern world and claiming, well, I've got those rights, by golly, I'm going to take them, or giving them up because of the betterment of the whole. I do see several of you smiling, so you know that I'm talking tongue-in-cheek there again. But he begins with something that is really a burning issue in his day, and especially in Corinth, as we have said over and over again, that great metropolitan, cosmopolitan kind of city. And that is, what do you do about food, in particular meat, that has been part of an offering in a pagan temple to a pagan god or goddess? And so he begins, "Now concerning food sacrificed to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up." Now, Paul is not here trying to say that we should not use our knowledge. But a slogan of some of the Corinthian Christians was, well, we've got knowledge and we know better than you, therefore we're going to tell you what to do. And what they had done was they had assumed positions of authority within the church without regard to other people that were around them in the church. Now, one might accuse Paul of doing the same thing. We've already seen in a couple of places, and in particular in chapter 7, where Paul says, now, I say to you, not the Lord, but I say to you, as if you're supposed to listen to him just like Jesus himself were speaking. And so when he begins here, what he's trying to do, I think, is to tell them, yes, you may have some knowledge, you may have some wisdom, you may have some understanding, but it should always be tempered by a sense of love and care and grace. Knowledge for knowledge's sake doesn't do you any good. Knowledge that is tempered by love builds up, not the person, but builds up or edifies the body. All of those believers and even those who are non-believers. And that is, regardless of what knowledge one may have, and he will fit this into the food offered to idols. Now, you know that these are really not gods, you know, but you shouldn't use your sense of knowledge and your sense of understanding to make other people, to put them down and keep them in their place simply because you know and you've got the right to do that. Rather, everything should be done, even though you may have certain rights and privileges because of your knowledge and your wisdom, you should temper that with love and with grace and with mercy. Anyone who claims to know something does not yet have the necessary knowledge, but anyone who loves God is known by Him. Now, he doesn't specifically say it, but most scholars think he is implying here that any one of you who thinks he knows something about God, because he says that in the very next phrase, anyone who loves God is known by him, is that some of the Corinthians, and in particular some of those that were later called super apostles, like Apollos and some of the others, tried to use their knowledge to keep other people where they wanted them to be, much like the Pharisees did. Remember, Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 goes on a tirade. Bless you. A tirade against the scribes and the Pharisees who misused their knowledge to try and keep people in the place they wanted them to be, instead of trying to open up vistas for them, vistas of understanding for them. They tried to keep them in their place, because he will say over and over again, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you traverse sea and land to make one single convert, and then you make them twice as fit for hell as you are. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, for you're like whitewashed sepulchres, all clean on the outside, but inside you're full of dead men's bones and uncleanness. Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, because you tithe of mint and dill and cumin. You even give because of, you know, you're knowing the law. You stand up in front of people puffed up and say, well, look, I even give back a tenth of the spices I buy at the store. Why you neglect the weightier matters of law and justice and righteousness. This is similar to what Paul is saying here. These folks are misusing their supposed knowledge of God to keep other people at arm's length, or to keep them where they want them to be. And so they're all puffed up about it and walking in with their thumbs hooked through their suspenders, looking down their noses. Yeah. Some of those folks that... I know y'all probably don't know any of these folks, but I went to high school with a couple of folks that we used to talk about sometimes, especially a couple of girls. They had their nose so high in the air that if they got caught in a shower, they'd drown. Yeah. Everybody else was beneath them. And that's what he's warning about here. Just because you've got the knowledge doesn't mean that you can use it to run roughshod over others. Just because you have a certain amount of knowledge doesn't mean that you're to get so puffed up, your head gets so swollen, you couldn't walk through the double doors. It's not knowledge for you, it's knowledge to help build up the whole. And a part of that is not demanding, well, I know this, so I'm right, and you have to kowtow to what I say. If you truly are known by God, then you will be called by God, and you will come to understand more of a sense of looking out for others, not just yourself. And so that's how this ties into the food offered to idols, because then he goes on to say, therefore, or hence, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that no idol in the world really exists, and that there is no God but one. So it doesn't matter. This city that's full of all these idols, full of the Corinthian idol, a very popular show back then. Dancing with the Corinthians? No, but he said, we know that all of these idols and all of these temples that are out here at which we worship, even though they might be in the shape of a little black box with a piece of glass in the front of it. No. The TV. Sorry. But, for some people that's an idol. Yeah, we've got all of these different things out here that really are not important like God is important. They are not the true measure of things, whereas God is. He said, we know that they really don't exist. There is no God but one. Indeed, even though there may be so-called gods in heaven and earth, as in fact there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist. And one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we exist. And he says, there are not other gods. And we exist not for other gods. We exist from God and for God. That's our number one existence and our number one allegiance. We get our life from God, and our lives and our knowledge and everything else exists for God. And there is one Lord through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Now, Paul here is also talking about not just we exist now, but we will owe our ultimate existence. Whatever state we are in our lives, we owe that to Christ, through whom we exist at all. Without Him, we would not even exist. And so he goes on then, it is not everyone, however, who has this knowledge. You know that, he says. But that shouldn't make you get all puffed up and make you think, hey, I'm better than everybody else. Rather, it should make you humble enough to where you know that and you are known by God, therefore you seek to share that with other people so they can know it. It's not your right and your privilege to hang on to it and keep it inside, like we were talking to the children this morning in the children's sermon, where the little girl, Lillian, got baptized and her mama reminded her as she was drying off, now the Spirit of God, or the Lord lives in you, and as she said, well, I feel Him rattling around, and then she goes, maybe I should keep, do I have to keep my mouth shut so He doesn't get out? No, we're not to keep it inside, we're to let it out. That's what he's saying here. It's not for us to keep to ourselves, but to allow others to come to know God, come to know Christ, and come to have that same sense of understanding that we do. It is not everyone, therefore, it is not everyone who has this knowledge. Since some have become so accustomed to idols until now, they still think of the food they eat as food offered to an idol. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled. He's referring specifically here to the Christian community. He's saying there are some, even within your Christian community, even within your church here in Corinth, who remain unenlightened they still are kind of hedging their bets. Well, yes, there is God and there is Jesus the Christ, but what if this other one does exist out here? They haven't been able to give up all of those vestiges. And he said, so when they've come to Christ and they've been told there are no other gods and that these idols are false, and yet they're not really sure, and so they don't know what to do and they don't know how to act. Not just within the church, but within the society at large. They're still under the illusion that pagan sacrifices have some power in and of themselves. They're operating under that illusion. Pagan sacrifices have some power in and of themselves. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled if they eat food that is offered to an idol. But, Paul says, food will not bring us closer to God. Food will not bring us closer to God. I beg to differ. But I know how he means it. But if we eat too much of the wrong, it might bring us closer to God quicker than we want to get there. I say that after we ate last night at the Valentine banquet. Yeah, but food will not bring us closer to God. It's not something that is going to bring us to God or not. Food offered to idols is not going to get you any closer to God than food not offered to idols. We are no worse off if we don't eat it, and no better off if we do. So what he's saying to them here is, really, for those who are weak, who don't understand, he says, those gods have no power, and that food has no power and no authority as it's been offered to a pagan idol or a supposed pagan god, and it's not going to make you any stronger or any weaker if you eat it or don't eat it. Food is food is food, is what he's saying here. There is no moral value to eating that food or to not eating that food. If we could only convince all those starving people in India. That it's okay to eat those cows walking around. But that's a different story. He said, we're no better off. And so some of the Corinthians there in the church, who are the knowledgeable ones, the stronger ones, start looking over at the weaker ones, the less knowledgeable and less sophisticated, and start saying, "Yeah, see? It doesn't matter. So we're going to go ahead and not only buy our meat at the meat market next to the pagan idol shop or the pagan temple, and we're going to serve it to you, and it doesn't matter." Now, Paul's trying to convince everyone it really doesn't matter that meat is not tainted unless it is tainted for you if you participate in the pagan festival. And it's not because of the meat. It's because of you being there and what you did. So while these puffed up knowledgeable ones are kind of looking down their noses at the ones that aren't as enlightened about this issue, Paul then goes on to say, but take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. The weak are hurt morally and spiritually if you misuse the knowledge you have and make them feel less important or force them to do those things when they shouldn't. Take care that this liberty, the fact that you're free to eat or not, does not become a stumbling block to the weak. If they are emboldened to eat contrary to their conscience, it only hurts them morally and spiritually and makes them weaker rather than stronger. And in fact, he seems to indicate here that probably the strong sin is in sinning against the weak, taking advantage of the weak. Not just in this, but passing the Kentucky Fried Chicken buckets when you're doing things that aren't exactly kosher. We continue. For if others see you who possess knowledge eating in the temple of an idol, might they not, since their conscience is weak, be encouraged to the point of eating food sacrificed to idols as well? So by your knowledge, those weak believers for whom Christ died are destroyed. But when you sin this way against members of your family and wound their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food is a cause of their falling, I will never eat meat so that I may not cause one of them to fall. Paul is really talking here not so much about food offered to idols as he is talking about boundaries of rights versus responsibility. While it may be legal and okay, in fact, later on in chapter 10, he says, he will say, now, not everything is lawful, but not everything's unlawful. And the real test is, does it edify the body or does it take away? Does it build up or does it tear down? To build up is to take a responsibility seriously, Paul says. To tear it down is to say, well, it's my right and I'm going to do it. I don't care what. And so he is really cautioning the people in this real world situation. I mean, this was a serious discussion for them. As we've said before, and I'll remind again, you know, very often in many of the towns of the ancient Middle East, where there were these temples and idols to these other supposed gods, when the sacrifices took place, I mean, they didn't burn the whole animal. Even the Hebrews didn't burn the whole animal when they sacrificed to Yahweh. They took blood and put it on the horns of the altar. They sacrificed the fat of the entrails, the fatty kidneys, and certain other fatty organs. That's what got burned. They took the meat, and it got eaten. I mean, it was more of a sin to waste the meat and not eat it. Although the priests got the right shank, that was their pay. In addition to being, you know, connected with the temple, the rest of their pay was they got the right shank, which was considered choice part of the lamb or the goat. But then the rest of it was consumed, was eaten. That was the same thing with the pagan idols. They would sacrifice the animal and they would burn or sacrifice to the god, generally, the fatty portions, because those were considered the choice for God. They'd sacrifice those things, and then the meat would be taken next door or across the street or down the block to the meat market and cut up and sold. And there were some who said, oh, but if it's offered in sacrifice to a pagan god, doesn't that taint the meat? And if we eat the meat, then doesn't that mean we're participating, we're agreeing that that god exists? And so that was the real argument here. And the argument was, on the one side, yes, that means that we are admitting that that god might exist, and if we eat that meat, then we're sinning against God. And on the other hand was the argument, but that god really doesn't exist, and it's meat is meat is meat. And as long as you don't go and participate in the festival and the sacrifice, you can go ahead and eat that meat. Let it spoil is even a worse sin. And so you got these two groups on both sides, even within the church, arguing among themselves as to what is proper to eat and not to eat. Wasn't any counting fat grams or points or anything else in this one. No cutting out carbs or adding carbs or anything else. It wasn't a matter of that kind of diet. It was a matter of whether it was all right to eat that meat because it had been sacrificed to a pagan idol. And what Paul eventually says in all of this, here and then later on in chapters 9 and 10, talking about rights versus responsibilities, Paul will say, the meat's fine. If you want to eat the meat, as long as you don't go participate in the festival, it's fine. Buy it, cook it, enjoy it. But don't invite somebody in to eat at your home, or they come to eat at your home and you know that they don't feel that way, and you go ahead and serve it to them anyway. And then tell them later, oh, by the way, 3 months later, I did. Oh, by the way, those, when we had barbecued those beef ribs and those pork ribs, and you thought the pork ribs were so good, that was really Bambi. And they didn't speak to me for 2 weeks. Did she? It wasn't her. It was a friend of ours who said, no, horrible to shoot deer, horrible to eat deer, never eat deer. And we boil those ribs, beef and the, to make them real tender, the beef and the venison ribs, put them out there on the grill, barbecued them. She and her sons, high school sons, ate some of both, and they just went on and on and on about how those pork ribs were so much better than those beef ribs. And I did. I waited 3 months before I told her that those were really venison ribs. And she didn't speak to me for 2 weeks. They were next door neighbors to us. Boys thought it was funny. But she didn't think it was too funny. And what Paul says is, if you know you've got this issue with another brother or sister in Christ, and they come over to eat, or you go to take a covered dish to their house, and you give it to them, and it's got meat in it, and if they ask you where this come from, don't lie to them, and then later say that. Or don't let them eat at your house, and then say, oh, by the way, wasn't that pretty good? Not bad for stuff that came from Apollo's temple, is it? Because what you're doing is you are taking your rights and trampling over theirs. And you're being irresponsible in doing so. That even though you have the right as a Christian, when you know that God is real and you have that right to go ahead and do those things, say those things, teach those things, be careful, because you have a responsibility to do it with grace and with mercy and with care, and sometimes not to do it at all, because it'll cause harm rather than good. So it's not just about food offered to idols, though for them that was a major issue here. He says the same thing in chapter 10 as he is talking about all of that. And he says, you know, it may all seem to be, all things are lawful, verse 23, but not all things are beneficial, in chapter 10. All things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Paul is trying to cite and correct a slogan in the Corinthian church that says, you know, we're free, and so we can do anything we want to because Christ has set us free. And he said, well, that might be okay. All things may be lawful, but not everything builds up and not everything is helpful. And that we as Christians, whether it's regarding food, whether it's regarding the way we live our lives in connection with our neighbors, whether it's regarding the way we approach others at work or in school or anything else, that we should always ask, we are free, but we are free also to always ask the question, is it going to hurt my brother or sister? Is it going to build up the efforts of the church, or is it going to build up the efforts of Christ between neighbors, between friends, even between family members, or is it going to destroy it and tear it down? And just because I can do it doesn't mean that I should do it. In fact, if it's going to cause problems for my neighbor or my family member, I should think very, very hard before I actually do it. He says in verse 24 of chapter 10, "Do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience, for the earth and its fullness are the Lord's." If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any questions on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, "Now this was offered in sacrifice," then don't eat it out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I mean the other's conscience, not your own. Why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why should I be denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved. Paul is saying once again, as I know I'm beating this dead horse here, and in France it's a delicacy. Dead horse. Now, but what is Paul is saying here is what is important is not self-interest, but the interest of others. The other's conscience is to be respected even when it's misinformed. We listen. We may try to not coerce, but we may try to convince them otherwise, but not by force and not by taking privilege or demanding our right, rather through grace and deference to the other person. Now that's a hard thing, because what seems to be our human nature? What's at the center of our human nature? Selfishness. Me. The three people generally at the center of our human nature, from children on up, that we're constantly fighting against. Me, myself, and I. They're a pretty formidable foe. We like to have our own way. Most folks do. Do we not? I mean, most of us like to have things go our way. We like to have our own way. Children, I want, I want, I want, I want. And then if we say, "No, you can't," we don't have to teach them to cry and scream and holler and pitch a fit for it, right? Turn blue in the face. But what Paul is saying is, in matters of, not just matters of theology, but even in matters of everyday living, while we may have rights to do certain things, we should always be thinking about the effect that that has on someone else. And if it's going to be negative and not positive, then we should reconsider what we do. And that's a hard thing to do. At least it is for me. It's a difficult thing for me to do. There are sometimes when it's more easily done than others, but there's sometimes where it's the last thing I want to do. And it wasn't just when I was raising my kids. You know, parents, we want to exert that, and sometimes we need to. But there are also times where we need to try and use that restraint and that grace and that mercy, even though we know that it's probably not going to go how we want it to go. That's the hard, hard thing. And that involves self-discipline. That involves self-discipline, which Paul goes back to in chapter 9, if we back up. In chapter 9, verse 24, through the first part of chapter 10. "Do you not know that in a race the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win it." But then he says, "Athletes exercise self-control in all things." They do? Seems like we've seen a lot of stuff on the news lately where they haven't. But anyway, they're supposed to. What he says is the best ones, the ones who really are concerned about not only doing their best and performing their best, but they have a sense of rights versus responsibilities. He said they exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we do it for an imperishable one. And he wants them to think back. Think about all these Olympic athletes, he's saying. All these athletes out here in these contests, and they push, and they strive, and they work, and they deny themselves, and they prepare themselves, and they're going after something that's fleeting. They may end up with, before it's over with, they might end up with an asterisk in the record book if they're not wiped out altogether. And they do it for something that perishes. We, in our Christian lives, not just to get to heaven, but in our daily living, he said, are working on an imperishable wreath. So I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air, but I punish my body and enslave it so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified. He said, you know, I preach this stuff and I preach this discipline to others. I myself should be doing the same thing. If we're telling others how they ought to live as Christians and what is morally right and morally wrong, then we shouldn't be so... I mean, if we're not careful, we'll just become so haggard. Because we were telling them one thing, we were doing something else. Haggard. Ted. He's not the only one. Jim and Tammy Faye, we could go down the list of folks that you know who tell you got to do this is how you got to do it, while they, on the other hand, are doing completely the opposite. He said, that's not our right. Our responsibility is to make sure that when we are telling others, proclaiming to others how they should approach their lives with God and their everyday living, we need to make sure that we too are disciplined. He talks even further, giving them warnings from Israel's history, where Israel got led by God, and they said, oh, God's the greatest and God's leading us and we've got all this privilege, therefore we can do anything we want to, and they ended up in front of the golden calf. When they were telling others there's only one God and He's out there, they ended up in front of the golden calf. But the good news that He gives us in all of that, you know, self-discipline, discipline, that's not an easy thing. We don't like to talk about it a lot of times, but is found in chapter 10, verse 13. No testing has overtaken you that is not common to everyone. God is faithful and will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing, He will also provide the way out so that you may be able to endure it. If I'd started that in the old King James, a bunch of y'all probably could have finished it for me, right? There's therefore now no temptation that has overtaken you, but such that is common unto man. But God, who is faithful, will not allow you to be tested more than that which ye are able, but will with the testing provide a way for you to overcome it. Responsible living involves living with tests. It involves living with questions. It involves living with having to make decisions on a regular basis, on a daily basis, of what is our responsibility as opposed to what is my right. And sometimes responsibility and rights are the same thing, but sometimes they're not. And it involves taking into account the consciences of others with whom we're trying to work and live and play. But it also involves remembering that in spite of all of that difficulty, in spite of all the discipline to which we are called and the times that we fail, God is faithful. He will not let us be tested or tempted beyond what we can do, but rather will provide a way to go through it and endure it and come out better on the other side. When Jesus said in the model prayer, "Lead us not into trial or temptation, but deliver us from evil," Jesus was not saying that we are to pray to God, "Don't ever let anything bad happen. That's pie in the sky by and by." That's not reality. We live in a world that is less than perfect. But what Jesus was saying we should pray is that God would not lead us into any or allow us into any trial or temptation that we do not find God providing us a way to overcome if we will but follow. And that's really what Paul is talking about here in that real life situation of food offered to idols, and it's my right to eat that. And it doesn't matter that it came from the pagan temple, and you just have to deal with it. And Paul said, no. There is right, but there's also responsibility. Tell that to teenagers when they get 15, 16 years old, and they say, "Bud, it's my right to drive a car and to get my driver's license." No, it's a responsibility and a privilege. It's not a right. So we need to be careful, according to Paul, to make sure that what we do and what we say do not overly infringe upon someone else. But rather, we should always err on the side of mercy and grace and deference. And that takes discipline. And that takes patience, sometimes a lot more than I've got. But then again, look at the rights that Jesus had over against the privilege and responsibility that he took. Questions? Comments, observations. See, this old dead stuff doesn't have any relevance today, right? Unfortunately, it does. Okay. Well, if not, then next time, we will look into chapter 11 at those issues with which we've already dealt as a church in some ways, but that are always out there within churches. Paul addresses, among other things, ideas of worship, including the role of women in worship, in chapter 11. And Paul deals with abuses surrounding the Lord's Supper that were taking place in the Corinthian church. And those abuses that were taking place were in actuality rights versus responsibility in the most sacred of their rituals in the early church. And we'll talk about that next time. Know this, that the Christian way, as we said this morning and as we've read tonight, is not just about being easy and doing whatever. There is freedom. Christ frees us, sometimes freeing us from ourselves. But he always frees us with responsibility, with privilege to live not just for ourselves, but to live for him, even in the lives of others, that they may know. God bless you. Thank you. Go in peace. Amen.